You are from the community school. Deforestation is the purposeful clearing of forests, and even though it has been identified as a problem, it is still widely practiced in different areas, especially in the tropics. According to conservation.org, 93% of tiger habitats have been destroyed by various things, such as rising sea levels, deforestation, temperature change, and natural disasters. There are several problems affecting different tiger habitats.
Sitting in a cubicle, staring at a screen, playing with the lighter in the pocket of my jeans. Let's start a riot.
Let's start a riot.
Let's start a riot.
Let's start a riot.
I'm tired of trading hours for so little in return.
Listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. You've reached Solidarity Spokane, Inland Northwest, local labor hour. I'm your host, Cat Sabotage. We'll be right back after a brief interview from the Flea Market Square. We gather acknowledging that we are on the ancestral lands of the Spokane Tribe of Indians and a multitude of tribes who are connected through shared history of trade, celebration, and resources. We make the acknowledgement to pay respects to their elders past and present, whose knowledge remains on these lands. Please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us together today. Join our community as we continue to learn about such truths and that we can take direct actions in solidarity with Native peoples towards restorative justice. Never be deceived that the rich will permit you to vote away their wealth and by extension their power. Hello, everybody. Happy Monday afternoon. That was a quote from Lucy Parsons, that fantastic labor leader, Cherokee woman who married a Confederate cavalry officer in the late 19th century and became a staple of the labor rights movement. If you don't know who she is, please run, don't walk, to your phone, wherever it is, and Google her right now. She's fantastic, and you need to know who she is. I'm very excited today to be joined in the studio by Dominic Braun. He is a retired professor of philosophy and organizer of the Dorothy Day Labor Forum. I have him in the studio to talk about the work that he's done and the things that he's seen in his travels, East and West. And I'm very excited to have him on the program. Welcome, Nick.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, Dylan. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
What a cool studio you've got here, too.
It's nice and cozy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I like the sign behind us. It's really nice. You sent me a really, really good email, which kind of talked about your story. And you were raised in Spokane. Is that correct?
I was. I went in high school here, Gonzaga Prep. I graduated from. And then I went to GU. And just a couple things about it have shaped my life as I've been thinking about it since I've returned here. I left Spokane in 69 swearing I would never come home.
I think we all go through that phase at one point or another. We're Spokane. Get me out of here.
Yeah, that was it. I'm at it. But I'm back. I'm back about 5-6 years and rethinking all sorts of things. In high school, there was a Dorothy Day house, a Catholic worker house, was run on Catholic worker principles, and it was pacifist. It gave out food. It had a little farm. It was a political thing. It became something different. Catholic Charities became kind of a big institutional thing later, which I don't really recognize, but at that time, it was fairly radical in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. And I hung around with it, saw the Catholic Worker newspaper, and it was anarchist, totally anarchist. Dorothy Day was an anarchist.
Which is not something you would typically associate with Catholicism now.
No, not really. Yeah,
anarchy bent.
It was a current in Catholicism, but pretty much on the edge. And condemned in certain circles.
And survived a little and still does in the liberation theologies of Latin America to some extent. Was it kind of a branch of that?
It's connected to it. And she actually, Dorothy Day, became a figure in Latin America as well. People paid attention to her. She went to jail over and over in the 50s, protesting bomb shelters. And her fight was against Catholics. She was Catholic, but the Catholics in the 30s, I know we were talking about earlier, you were just reading about the Franco and the war, but
yeah,
the Catholics were a little confused on that in this country.
They didn't know which side to pick.
Yeah, they didn't know which side they were on, and Franco sounded like he was Catholic, and Mussolini said was Italian, so he must be Catholic. And so there were Catholics who were kind of confused about what was going on in Europe.
Do we support the leader who's getting guns and tanks from the Nazis, or maybe these other guys who say they're anarchists?
It was a real problem.
That is a problem.
And she fought against that, and that's why she called it a worker movement, went to the Communist Party area of New York called Union Square, and handed out her first issues on May Day.
Fitting.
And said, we're here too. People said, well, how could it be? But she said, actually, there's a current in the Catholic Church that is pro-labor. And she found it, promoted it, and had anarchist friends very very definitely all through her life. Mm. Played a role in the 60s.
I just think that's so interesting. This is the first time I'm really learning about this crossover or anything having to do with that. Can you say a little bit more about Dorothy Day and what happened to her throughout her life? Or,
well, she was in the Communist Party, I think, and the Communist Party wasn't around really until 1920, 21, 22, really. Mm-hmm. But she was a communist. She interviewed Trotsky when Trotsky was living in New York. She's quite a clever journalist. Mm-hmm. Was in radical circles, and at somewhere or another, she in the 20s felt the need for some religious side. Became mm-hmm. Catholic, and but didn't want to give up the radical worker side that she represented. And at that time, the Catholic Church was condemning communism terribly. just right. absolutely encyclicals against it.
That first Red Scare atheistic communism. After World War
I. So she was on the outside, and she was fighting a powerful, powerful figure, Cardinal Spellman, who once posed with a machine gun.
He sounds like an angry wizard.
Yeah. So she was. That's who we actually named our group after, Dorothy Day.
Right.
Not because she's Catholic. Actually, to a certain degree, the opposite. She challenged the Catholics. You know, said, "Come on, get going." It was during a time we founded the Dorothy Day Labor Forum when there was strike preparation at Providence Hospital. Mm-hmm. Providence Hospital nurses and the other workers felt that they were being shafted in the culture change that's going on in that hospital mm-hmm. that once had Catholic roots, was run by nuns. Mm-hmm. It used to be a family and now was run by this Providence institution, which sounds religious, Providence, but it's actually a business, I think, in Texas.
And which is all over the West.
All over the West.
There are Providence institutions up north, down south, on the west coast of the state, in Oregon. I mean, they're a monolith. They're massive.
I don't know if they still claim to be nonprofit, but they aren't nonprofit, never have been.
Healthcare? Nonprofit.
No, millions of dollars go to the CEOs and stuff like that.
Must be a line they missed on the tax document,
yeah,
I'm sure.
It's just a business. It's a crude business. And to a certain degree, we picked that name Catholic Worker for our group mm-hmm. to kind of signal that. And we found out as soon as the nurses came, one of the nurses said, you know, I was in a Catholic worker house in Seattle. I'm a radical too. So right away. And the second reason we did was named it for Dorothy Day was because at Gonzaga, there was a youth movement, quite an interesting little group, USAS, United Students Against Sweatshops, which that year was the largest student group in America.
Was this in 2019?
Yes, 2019.
Okay.
USAS. It was quite a vigorous chapter, and it was organizing cafeteria workers. Gonzaga had, at one time in the past, run its own cafeteria with local workers, but now had sold out its cafeteria to a prison food outfit, a giant prison food outfit, a very fast, high income. Anyhow, I can't remember the name of it suddenly. Sodexo. Yeah.
And they were taking inmates.
They ran the cafeterias, and they run the cafeteria workers crazy.
Right.
And so they were interested in that. And we thought, well, that's everybody at Gonzaga knows there is this spirit that's supposed to be pro-labor in the Catholic Church, the Dorothy Day spirit. So, and Daniel Berrigan, that's another name, someone who followed her. The Jesuits knew that, so we threw that in there for them, mm-hmm. too. So that's kind of how it got named Dorothy Day Labor Forum. But it's not religious. It's an organization of my wife and I founded it to look at labor history, to look at labor problems, and we do somewhat what you're doing to a certain degree. We have a monthly forum, mm-hmm. and we have a newsletter that comes out. And it's always had 10 or 15 people, you know, writing articles for it. So it's pretty snazzy. And
if you wanted to get a copy of the Dorothy Day Labor Forum, how would you go about that?
Someone could actually email me directly if they wanted.
Okay.
My name is Nick. So it's N Braun, B-R-A-U-N-E, N Braun at ATT.net.
Okay.
Yeah, so that would be good. Also, they could call you, and you could tell them.
Absolutely. I've been receiving it for quite a long time. So
everyone gives these things. Whenever somebody says, you know, I want to write, I never can find a pencil when I'm on the when I'm listening to something. I never can find something to write on. So anyhow, yeah, that was high school, and then in college, I was involved in anti-war activity. Mm-hmm. There was a little anti-war group at Gonzaga, and I was in touch with them.
This was contemporary with, you know, Kennedy had just been president, or we're talking the early 70s. I mean, this was the Nixon.
No, we're talking about 60s.
60s still.
This is the radical 60s. Now I'm in the late 60s at Gonzaga U.
Okay, so we're still
a person. It was a pretty stodgy school, but it did have some radicals.
Mm-hmm. Any that stick out in your mind? Any faculty members that you loved that maybe are not with us anymore? That you
Actually, there was a dean of students who was a priest. His name was Father Rice, something like that. No, his father. I'll think about it later.
Right.
Anyhow, I was a dean of students. It'll click me. And he was a Jesuit priest. And 1 year after I left, he quit the Jesuits, moved to Chicago, and became a member of the what's now the Revolutionary Communist Party. Mm-hmm. The a group founded in Chicago, a kind of radical Maoist Communist Party.
Maoist?
Yeah.
Not Stalinist, Leninist, any of that, but Maoist, okay.
Where the Communist Party was actually more toward the Soviet Union, but mm-hmm. There were Maoist groups which were coming about, which wanted to serve the people like the Panthers did, and wanted to reach the peasantry as well. Mm-hmm. And he joined that and stayed with it for many, many years.
And was this time at Gonzaga was when you discovered Marxism?
Yeah, that whole time, yeah. My father was actually a Marxist, so I visited him. He lived in Seattle and was actually, to a certain degree, a labor lawyer. He worked with the a union that was being kind of kicked out by the FFL-CIO.
Okay.
Mine, mill, and smelter workers.
Uh-huh.
They were red-baited like crazy, and
you mean to say that the AFL-CIO at that time was trying to expel anyone that had any kind of communist affiliations because it was seen as un-American and harmful?
That's right. That's right. Really, I know that people today look at the unions and they say, well, they're awfully conservative. And what I do is I kind of study how that happened. Mm-hmm. Just actually how it happened. Because if you look at the 30s, for instance, the unions were fighting the companies, they were fighting the National Guard to a certain degree. They had sit-down strikes. Now, it doesn't sound radical to sit down.
No.
But it's extremely radical because it challenges capitalist property relations. Mm-hmm. What do you mean you occupy it? It's ours. I mean, you can wind out there and pick it if you want, but the machinery is ours. No, we're sitting on it.
And this is that distinction they make between private and personal property. I often find that folks, when they're looking at communism or syndicalism or another offshoot of leftist philosophy, get really hung up on that idea that private property is theft, where a communist would tell you or a syndicalist will tell you that we're not talking about your personal property, which you would consider your house.
Right.
We're talking about the private property of the capitalist, which would be the factory where you produce the product that you're selling your labor in.
Right. That's right. And they did not respect the property rights of the owners to for this building. They sat in and we work it. We probably built it.
Right.
We made you the money. So why should we stand out on the sidewalk? And but that did cause a lot of fights. And that was that kind of ferment changed labor for the good mm-hmm. in the 30s.
And then there was still that brutal push. And it seems that the wars, World War I and World War II, had great effect on the labor movement, and particularly in fomenting this idea of hypernationalism and cutting out people who were not willing to toe the line and contribute to the war effort. That is to say, anybody who was wanting to go on strike or better their working conditions at that time, they said, no, we have got to go defend democracy abroad, and if you are not with us, then you are clearly against us. I mean, many examples of laws being passed during that time, sedition acts and the like, which targeted those members and got many incarcerated for close to the rest of their lives.
Oh, it was very bad during the last part of World War One, and when we came in. Mm-hmm. For a while, we weren't in World War One. We were kind of late joining because it didn't make sense.
Why would we?
What was it about? Bob Dylan says, you know, the reason for fighting, I never got straight. You know? He studied and studied, and he couldn't figure out who was right in World War One.
And workers don't want to go to war anyway because, you know, a communist will tell you that you are just fighting the other proletariat on the other side. You're having a war between two landowning entities that want more land for more money, and your sons and daughters are going to be the ones that are sent to fight and die.
That was the view of labor in this country. The socialist movement in this country was don't go to war.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we fight someone who's dressed, you know, a different outfit? You know,
right? And it speaks a different language because we're both just going to get boxes back with our sons in them.
That's right. So we didn't get in the war right away, but when the United States did join the war, it cracked down on the Wobblies. It cracked down on the Socialist Party.
Mm-hmm. Eugene Debs got his one-way ticket to jail.
A million votes in this country in 1920 for president when he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
That's really significant.
It is, and many of those votes coming from places like Oklahoma, where you would not expect, you know, but there was a strong socialist presence
there
in the Midwest.
There was a socialist party down there. Yeah, they had socialist... They had socialist baseball teams. They had so many of them. They're playing against.
There's a lot of people in Oklahoma that would like to forget about that right about now.
Yeah, I know.
But they gave us Woody Guthrie, so I'm happy about it.
Another thing that's interesting about that period, there were unions in this country before that, and before the 19-teens, but they'd gotten pretty conservative. They got, because the very first union in this country was the Union of the Cordwainers. Nobody knows what a cordwainer is anymore, but a cordwainer is someone who makes shoes. The cordwainers wanted a union, and they didn't want the cobblers who fix shoes to try and come over and make shoes. So the cordwainers had a union to keep the cobblers out and to keep the women out. And to keep others out of their trade. We didn't want everyone trying to make shoes. You know, so the Cordwainer Union is the very first. But it's a union. There's no doubt about it. It's a union. They protect their
interests.
Their interests. But it's aimed at other workers to a certain degree.
Right. Labor v. labor.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the cobblers got a union, you know, because we didn't want the cordwainers to come in and fix shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You stay over there making shoes. We fix shoes.
So this is a gripe my granddad had about unions, is that he can change a light bulb perfectly well. Why does he have to call an electrician in to get that done? I've heard that gripe before, yeah.
And it's still true to some degree, but those kinds of unions became business unions. It was kind of a business. They were protecting their business. They were protecting it from others, and they weren't by nature trying to find allies. They weren't trying to find the women as allies. The slaves, the blacks as allies, the unemployed as allies, foreigners as allies. Mm-hmm. That was, oh no, we're against this and that. No one comes in, we're protecting our union. And they still see that in certain trade unions. But in the 30s, and then again, a little bit in World War One, and a little in the 20s, but definitely in the 30s, you have industrial unions. And they're not trying to protect a craft. They're saying, everybody in the auto industry, I don't care what you do, we want you to be in our union.
Yes.
All the miners, no matter if you run the machine or you clean up afterwards, all the miners are going to be in it.
Because then we're not going to be busy infighting, and we're going to be able to collectively actually improve the lot of all of us.
Yes. And so the 30s have a different aura than the previous period, the old craft unions. What happened is after...
And Nick, I'm going to cut you off real quick because we're gonna have to go to a real quick break, and then we're going to be right back and we're going to talk a little bit more about this.
Oh, good. The union's the only gang that gives a hang about me. The union's the only gang that gives a hang about me. My senator and representative don't give a dang about how I live, but the union gang, they give a hang about me. Oh, yes, I'm you.
Captain Maid as we head out and about, featuring LGBTQ folk, friends, allies, and all who make Spokane a better place through inclusion, creativity, truth, and beauty. local stories, conversations, and creations with universal appeal. Out and About, every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on KYRS.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for July 17th through the 20th. Monday, Dave and Ray at Brick West, Dream Theater, Devin Townsend, and Animals as Leaders at First Interstate Center for the Arts, Google Bordello at the Knitting Factory, and Open Mic hosted by Lucas Brookbank Brown at the Red Room. Tuesday, Nick Groh at Riverfront Eats, Dallas K at True Legends, Steve Earle at the Bing, Mark Ward and the Scissor Kicks at Trailbreaker Cider, and the Nightmares at Zola. Wednesday, Jerry Lee Raines at the Wave, Charles Wesley Godwin and Wyatt Flores at the Knitting Factory, Open Mic at the Checkerboard, and the Roommates Jam at the Red Room. Thursday, Ron Green at the Steam Plant, Rosie Zircone at the Mac, Evan Denlinger at True Legends, Jason Perry at Craft and Gather, Villa Blues and Jazz at Coeur d'Alene Park in Brown's Edition, Zuiel Bailey with the Ataka String Quartet at Hamilton Studio, DJ Yella at the Red Room, Pop Love at the Checkerboard, and Zonky Jazz Band at Kendall Yards for Rock the Nest. For an entire hour of Spokane area musicians, tune into For the Love of the Music every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
KYRS Medical Lake Spokane is made possible by the contributions from viewers or listeners in the community. If you like what we're doing, if you like the messages that are coming out over the airwaves to you that are censored or maybe excluded by mainstream media, and you want to keep your local radio station alive and prospering for many years to come, please consider texting Give KYRS to 44321. That's Give KYRS to 44321, and make any contribution that you would like to keep our radio station alive and thriving. The mission of Planned Parenthood is to ensure all people have access to the care and resources they need to make informed decisions about their bodies, their lives, and their futures. Each year, Planned Parenthood delivers vital reproductive health care, sex education, and information to millions of people in the United States and around the world. Information online at PlannedParenthood.org. Now, Nick, just before the break, we were discussing the fragmentation of unions as they had been for large iterations of the 19th and then into the 20th century. But in the 30s, you were saying that they became larger industrial unions.
Yeah, the and had a certain spunk and drive, and they were actually an extension to a certain degree. They weren't unions protecting workers that are employed against the unemployed. They were linked to the unemployed leagues. They considered themselves part of the campaign for full employment. Workers had a different kind of mentality in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And that's the time that Dorothy Day wanted to get Catholics out of their little parishes, where they were sitting and saying, oh, the world's anti-Catholic. We're just going to protect ourselves. You know, get out of your parishes. Join the unions. So there's communists in it. Big deal. Get out and do it. it's a class-wide process. So it's a big difference. At that time, there were tremendous successes, and the unions were pretty much in line with Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. They were pretty much in line with the. It was almost a kind of emergence of a welfare state, but not really. It was kind of, the word, it's a kind of strange concept, but it's something is called positivism. Mm-hmm. It's a thought that sociologists came up with, that if really smart people would get together, we could plan our way so that there's order and progress. And the Brazil's flag says order and progress. Really scary flag to me. And there's a thing called Latin American positivism that's always been kind of a problem. Certain kind of people say, look, we're the smart ones. We know we're the best and the brightest. We can hang around with Roosevelt. We can get the labor unions with us. And everyone's kind of working together to end this depression and build Grand Coulee Dam. Mm-hmm. Get this thing built. Everyone was for it. It was electrification. Mm-hmm. As the song went, I think it was Woody Guthrie said, mm-hmm. I don't like dictators, none, but the whole country ought to be run by electricity.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, but it was a kind of thought about, and the, so the unions did come in together with the government to a certain degree mm-hmm. at that point, and the government helped actually make sure that there were certain protections for unions. They wouldn't be beaten up too much by the National Guard, et cetera.
As it happened so, many, many times before.
Yes. So the government and the unions did work together a bit in the Roosevelt administration. And then World War II comes. And suddenly, we're all together.
And it should be noted, too, before we leave the 30s, that that was the birth of the National Labor Relations Act. So that was a really seminal time for the development of laws which protected labor, because previously, private employers did not have to recognize constitutional rights of workers in a private enterprise. So they did not necessarily have those protections.
Yes, there were definitely protections offered in the Roosevelt administration, mm-hmm. and the Democrats were kind of close to the labor unions. So there's no doubt about it.
Begrudgingly, a little
passing more. For this kind of project. And the unions were growing mm-hmm. and were energetic.
And then
World War II comes, and everyone's got to agree. We all agree. We're going to have no strike pledges all over the place. There'll be no strikes.
Mm-hmm.
The conversion of auto was done by a plan called the Reuther Plan. Walter Reuther was the head of the union, and he develops this plan to convert it to convert automobile making to tank making.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge push. It becomes super patriotic. It's patriotic to work with the government. It's anti-patriotic and anti-American not to work with the government.
Familiar, slightly.
It gets really thick at that time.
Right.
And then you're going to start seeing the labor laws change after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The government will control the unions. We will settle all the NLRB will settle all the disputes.
Mm-hmm.
We will settle that. We are demanding that everyone who's a labor leader will have to sign this statement that they're not a communist.
Which took out a lot of the IWW and those other syndicalist members.
Yes, and I wouldn't have signed that if I was a communist or not. You know, whose business is it? You know, it's a free country.
Right.
I can't be a Marxist. So, I mean, the war's over. We were allies with Stalin fighting Hitler, and we beat Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
So,
together.
The changes going on in Russia, it's good ones. So, what is this? You know, so... But 80,000 union leaders, people paid by unions, signed the statement. We are not affiliated with the Communist Party. We deny that any, blah, blah, blah. So and the NLRB starts to take tremendous power. It's the unions here's a statistic that blow you over. In 1940, if you take a piece of paper, just a blank piece of paper, and put it on a desk, that's how many people there are in unions in this country. That piece of paper.
An 8.5 by 11.
Yeah, about that size. Just a kind of 7 by 11 piece of paper. You got one. Put it down in 1940. But by 1960, 20 years later, it had grown. It had sextupled. It would be six of those pieces of paper in a row. In 20 years, it sextupled. Why? Well, because the unions were industrial unions. And industry is booming in the war and booming in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want a job in industry, mining, steel, rubber, mining, whatever it is, auto, etc., mm-hmm. it's union, and you have to be in the union. They're no longer fighting to get unions.
Mm-hmm.
People, they're just coming into unions because the industries are unionized.
And right-to-work laws were not even conceived of at this point.
Yes, it was certainly right. And it was growing like crazy. And many of the companies that used to have company unions said, well, these unions worked so well with the government during the war and after. I mean, they converted their company. It called the FFL and the AFL and say, won't you help, you know, let this group join.
Yeah.
So the unions grew like crazy. There weren't many strikes. There were no strikes in World War II. Very few between the end of World War II and 1960.
Mm-hmm.
The strike funds grew. The unions grew in membership. The companies had the check off. So they didn't have to run and ask the members for union. The unions just were paid every month by the companies. The unions had tremendous power. Mm-hmm. They had lots of money. They were consulted by business. City councils asked the opinion of labor on all issues. The Democratic Party was cozying up. We are the party of labor.
I'm sensing that there's a but.
There is.
There's going to be a very large but.
There is. But it wasn't the same kind of struggle. There was no struggle to get the union. It wasn't the 30s workers. It was just people who were incorporated into these unions, happy to be in the unions and pay their dues. They hadn't struggled for the unions. They weren't interested in going to meetings. They would much rather watch Milton Berle on TV. So union attendance went down. Union membership was up. Unions had lots of money. And because they had these connections to the war, they integrated themselves to the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? They integrated themselves into the Cold War.
Well, the AFL and the CIO merged in 1955. So the old unions, the craft unions, and the industrial unions merged to become big labor. Mm-hmm. They had lots of money, so they set up free labor unions, democratic, anti-communist labor unions in country after country.
Mm-hmm.
They worked with the CIA on that. They cooperated in getting communists out of the unions. They did, you know, they went further and further to the right.
This is the history of McCarthyism.
And they catered to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we fought in the war. We're against communism. Well, what does that have? We weren't fighting communism in the war.
We were fighting fascism.
We were fighting fascism. But we were in the war fighting communism. No, you were in the war fighting fascism, and the communists were on your side. It was too confusing for them, but they were super patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
And the ads played for them. You know, this is, see the USA in your Chevrolet. America's the greatest land of all. It was patriotic to mm-hmm. take a trip with your family to see America. Don't go to Europe.
And to buy an American car. And
buy American. The unions are for it. Buy American, not those Jap cars.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that kind of talk.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible kind of talk. And it was unions.
Mm-hmm.
So when the 60s take place, when the fight for civil rights takes place, really, when the student rebellion takes place, when the emergence of the feminism takes place, labor wasn't there. And some labor was organized by its labor leaders to demonstrate for the Vietnam War and against the students.
And you're talking about mostly about the leadership of the craft unions. You're talking about the leadership,
yes,
not standing,
yes,
behind
craft,
rank and file workers who may have held different opinions.
Yes, the leadership of the craft unions. And remember, they've merged. CIO has merged with the craft unions.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't CIO AFL. It's AFL first dash CIO. And the head of it is a guy named George Meany, who's AFL, totally CIA, totally
mm-hmm.
pro-military, anti-communist, and asking the government at all points, can't you help us get gangsters out of the unions?
They were referring to the work that Bobby Kennedy was doing on the Rackets Committee, the
yes,
Teamsters,
Bobby Kennedy, yeah,
who were really known for, you know, shakedowns or mm-hmm. you know, extortion, racketeering, all that good stuff,
right. This wasn't the unions cleaning themselves up. This was the government intervening.
Right.
And the unions that didn't cooperate, you know, they didn't get the money, they didn't get, yeah. So it was a very reactionary force, labor at the top in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It was for the increased missiles. It was for, it was against communist, it was against Cuban Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It was for free trade unions overseas. It helped overthrow countries. It overthrew Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
The AFL-CIO helped on that.
You're talking about the other 9/11. You're talking about Pinochet and the rise,
yeah,
of him in...
Right. Right. All of this, all of that stuff that's taking place, the rebellion of the colonies against Britain and Belgium and France and America, the Third World revolutions.
And they needed to capitalize on that.
Yes, they were against it. You know, they were pitted against it. This doesn't mean the working class, but it was a damper on the working class. It was a horrifying thing that the workers weren't in on the 1960s, mm-hmm. in on those massive demonstrations.
I think it's really interesting, too, that when we lost Martin Luther King, he was not at a demonstration for civil rights. He was not at a demonstration speaking as he had, you know, for equal rights before the law for African Americans. He was at a
in Memphis, yeah,
with the striking sanitation workers.
That's right.
And
that's right.
His politics at that time had become similar in the way to the leader in the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton. They had become very community oriented and community minded, and were talking more and more and more about a radical redistribution of America's wealth,
right.
and began talking about wealth inequality even then,
right?
Which had established a trend, right. and strangely are no longer with us.
Yeah.
Similar veins from other leaders who are also somehow no longer with us.
You know, the 60s was just an amazing transformation in this country. It was in the 50s, everybody was quiet and clean when they went to church.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, they started to wear jeans.
Mm-hmm. Grow their hair.
Students, yeah, they did different. It looked different. They challenged their teachers. You had Black studies, Chicano studies.
Mm-hmm.
You had people tearing up their draft notices and then appealing. One of the things that was done, I read this thing that someone had torn up and burned in public his draft notice 6 times. I said, how could you do that? I mean, you only burn it once. You know, you only have one. Yeah.
You only have one.
But yeah. They apply again. Would you send me a card? I lost my card.
Can you send it again?
Yes. He says 6 times. I lost my card. Can you send me another one? So, So that was the 60s. One of the great disappointments was labor wasn't there. It could have been a revolution.
Very much so.
It could have been a revolution. Had labor been there, had really been there.
And then, of course, there has to be the necessary backlash, because there are interests in the country that have existed and have always existed who do not benefit if labor benefits, who will come together and form a united front against that. Chomsky talked about this in his, many times, and other intellectuals have pointed it out also, but the Powell Memorandum and its significance to the uniting of the business front as they moved in to reclaim the government.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the labor unions and the government getting all nice and comfy cozy, and then there came a moment where they decided they were going to shove a wedge right in between that.
Yeah.
Because the government is working a little too well for the people. They're getting a little too many rights. We are losing control of this situation. And I believe the exact wording from that memorandum reads, if we are to protect the interests of business in this country, we need to act quickly because the hour is late. And of course, seeing all of these different forces where they were worried about the Black Panthers and they were worried about, oh my gosh, there are Black people with guns at state capitals. We can't have that. We can't have, you know, we can't have an expanding system like this that's energizing these factions. So we really need to tamp them down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the law and order president. Mm-hmm. You had the crackdown where people finally said, and after a successful terror campaign had been waged on the progressive leaders of the late 60s, assassination after assassination, you had Kennedy, you had the other Kennedy, you had Fred Hampton, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers. I mean, people were just dropping dead left and right. And you can understand how it would be easy to appeal in a media format after the advent of television that this has got to stop. I mean, we had our fun, but... You know, yeah. Right or wrong,
right.
They were trying very much to toe that line, and it worked. And now, and that strategy has been employed ever since. Right, you are in danger. There are people on your TV who have weapons and who may have dark skin who are coming to hurt you. But you know, the police and the government will protect you by being tough on crime and by, you know, cracking down on those radical elements that are threatening your freedoms. And it's worked very well. for 50 years ever since.
Yeah.
And now you talked about a sextupling of the labor force, and now we are at 6%.
Yeah, shrunk totally.
Almost entirely. Right. Growing up in my generation, the talk of a union was almost absurd. People really didn't think about that. And we're going to get into a little bit more of that after this next break.
If we can't get more for labor, we'll starve to death and die. Don't go under the mountains with a cedar hanging over your head. Please don't go under the mountains with a cedar hanging over your head. And work for just blood.
I'm Marcy Winograd, inviting you to tune in to Code Pink Radio every Thursday at 9 a.m. for conversations with global peacemakers calling for a ceasefire in Ukraine, freedom from occupation for Palestine, climate justice for the global South, and a lot more. Code Pink is a feminist grassroots organization working to end U.S. warfare and imperialism, support peace and human rights, and redirect resources into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming programs. That's Code Pink Radio every Thursday at 9 a.m. right here on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio.
Springtime is here, and with it comes spring cleaning. But how can you benefit yourself and the community? By donating your car, boat, or truck. We will tow the vehicle and give you a tax receipt for your donation. Call toll-free now to 855-KYRS-CAR. That's 855-597-7227. Start your spring off clean. Get ready for love,
yeah, yeah. Well, it's certainly not spring anymore. I wasn't particularly ready for the second break that we had. I've been having such a good time speaking to Nick here in the studio that I'm getting the time a little wrong. So we got about 10 minutes left before we wrap everything up. I do really wish it was spring, though, again, with all that summer ahead of us. So we were just discussing before the break, for those just tuning in, I am with Nick Braun. He is one of the organizing and founding members of the Dorothy Day Labor Forum, a local periodical here in town, which you can find and subscribe to. I think, Nick, how would somebody get in touch with you and subscribe to what's in the DDLF? And we probably should get a little bit back onto that for just a minute to cover what's actually in it, because we kind of just got off on our own tangent like we do.
Yeah, I like the tangents, so that's no problem with me. The N Braun, B-R-A-U-N-E, N-B-R-A-U-N-E, at ATT.net.
And what I love about it...
And you'll get a newsletter, and which comes out monthly. You can write for the newsletter. I'm talking to the audience here.
Anybody.
Anyone can write for it. It's and we have a monthly forum. We're going to have a forum on Thursday night of this week with United Food and Commercial Workers who are working to organize the cannabis workers.
We just had them on the show last week.
Yeah, I know. So
when is that going to be?
This should be pretty good. That'll be Thursday night at 7. Mm-hmm. And there's a person from the Socialist Party. Now it's called the Freedom Socialist Party in Seattle. Freedom Socialists are a breakoff from the Socialist Workers Party way back when, but they are fairly big in Seattle, and they've got a study of a Biden's treatment of the railroad workers.
Yeah, can we talk about this a little bit? Because I know you and I were talking about this briefly the other day. You are up to snuff on labor, and you're an advocate, and you're a fierce advocate at that. What is your grade if you had to give Biden a grade in the Biden administration grade on?
Oh, Biden gets an F. Yeah, he should drop. Yeah, Biden's
but
an
Nick, he's the he says he is the most pro-labor president that has ever lived.
It's just astounding. He says that too. And it was a heartbreak to me when about 1 month ago, the AFL-CIO endorsed him.
I said, very quickly.
Yeah, it was a year earlier than they'd endorsed any candidate before in election year. I mean, they usually do it in the summer before the election.
Mm-hmm.
But this is before there's even in primaries. They've endorsed Biden. And I was a little disappointed with AOC this week, too.
How so? Not often you hear words of reprimand for AOC.
Yeah, she endorsed Biden for president. Again, why? Why right now? They're not even getting a chance of even the Democrats to run against him, to pose against him. But what we are, if we have to get back to this thing, the connect up, labor went through, it became part of the government, became thick with it, and it lost. It kind of buttered up the powers that be in the 60s, didn't go along with the revolutionaries, and then the industrial capacity of the country dried up. We had the Rust Belt cities.
Mm-hmm.
The industrial workers aren't there. And now the unions are really very weak.
Mm-hmm.
What our goal is, I don't believe that the unions on their own can win too much. And I don't believe the rank and file workers are the key either. I know that the rank and file workers have to kind of revitalize the unions. I think it's good to do, but I don't think it's just waiting for the workers to get angry and the unions to get angry. And it's not just getting the rank and file workers to get the get them mobilized to get angry to really get back what we've lost, any of that. I think the only thing that's going to change this is it's going to have to be what's called a mass strike process. It's not a formal general strike.
Mm-hmm.
Like we kind of vote on a general strike. Let's get together and vote on a general strike. There's something else going on in a mass strike. Rosa Luxemburg talks about it. It's a linkage between areas. It's what didn't take place in the 60s. The workers, the students, and the community groups have to unite and work together.
Yes.
We've got to get together. For instance, let's look at the UPS workers. UPS is now very, very close to going on strike. And DSA is all excited. They're getting all sorts of they're sending messages out. We got to really support the strike. It's got to do this. We've got a really radical section in the union.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to win this strike.
Mm-hmm.
I'm for winning it. I really am for it. But one of the things that we put out in our newsletter is something the postal workers did.
Mm-hmm.
When the postal workers were fighting for their survival in the Trump administration, they called for electric trucks, electric vehicles. Why? Because they want to link with the environmental groups.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you've got to do. We've got to actually reach the students, reach the environmental groups, reach the community groups that are talking about the landlords in Spokane,
mm-hmm.
The tenant organizations. You have to get labor thinking about class-wide issues.
Class consciousness.
Yes, real class consciousness, not trade union consciousness. Radical trade union consciousness, really militant trade union consciousness. Trade union consciousness that emerges from the rank and file doesn't make socialism. Lenin makes it clear. Rosa Luxemburg makes it clear. What's actually going to be needed is a mass strike process where there's ferment in other areas linking up. These are our allies in the tenants' right people. These are our allies in the environmental groups. These are our allies in the students against sweatshops.
And you're talking also
it's
about
a mass thing, not a general strike of the unions,
mm-hmm.
but a mass strike process where the individual feels for the first time in their life where they see all sorts of people changing. You'll see someone who feels like they can't talk because if I say something, I'll probably mispronounce it, or somebody will say, well, you didn't, that's been tried, or what do you know? You didn't even go to college or something. But suddenly in a mass strike process, the worker looks out and sees ferment in other areas, sees life and motion in the surrounding groups, and feels for the first time that he can make a speech. And that's why there's new labor. That's why in the 1930s, you're working with the unemployed leagues and this kind of thing. That's why there was suddenly orators, that unbelievably good orators. Mm-hmm. And in the 60s, in the black population, tremendous orators. Mm-hmm. I went to the Black Panther Party United Front Against Fascism conference. It was a huge conference in Oakland. I was amazed, but there was, you'd have tremendous oratorical skill coming from people from community colleges,
which you can't help but notice is markedly absent in the present day. You don't even really, and we have televisions and radios now, but televisions and phones now, but I mean you just look around and you find that, you know, it's very difficult for anybody to come up with any kind of rousing speech or even elevate their voice enough to reach across the room, and you're like,
I know,
I wonder what happened.
Yeah.
But we have run out of time for the show today. But
how much time's left?
19 seconds. What do you got?
Yeah, this has really been a joy. Thank you very much. You're a wonder, and I think this program is great. I hope it really succeeds. I'll tune in and cheer it on.
Thank you. I'm very happy to have you in my chair today, and I'm happy to hear your experiences and the knowledge that you have. There's just such a huge slog of book learning and history that you have to do to access the history of labor, because this isn't something that they teach up front and center in public school or even in higher education. It's not really something that people really, really tune into. So having folks with your expertise and your years of experience is very, very helpful. Do you have any words of wisdom for the rank and file workers who may be listening over the airwaves today?
Look for allies outside your union. Look for them and figure out how you can address them and bring them in and start thinking about this trade union militancy becoming class militancy.
And if you have a story, if you have work that you're doing in your community, if you have an organization, or you just want to talk about your job and you, or you just want to talk about how high your rent is getting and why, no matter how hard you work, you can never keep up with that rising ceiling and get just a little bit ahead, remember, you can send us an email at solidaritiespokane@kyrs.org or thelastspokanewobbly@gmail.com. This has been us for this week. If you, we did not have a labor report for you this week, so I have to mention really briefly, Nick was talking about finding workers outside of your particular field of work and looking for other organizations. I think that the speech that Fran Drescher gave this week with the SAG after strike is absolutely fire, and you should go check that out because she's speaking for a lot of voices in the labor movement, and it's about 6 minutes, so just give it a Google real quick. Fran Drescher, SAG after a strike. Thank you very much. I'm Kat Sabotage. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Suffocating heat is gripping three continents as the summer's record-breaking temperatures continue to scorch large swaths of the United States, Asia, and Europe. 100 million U.S. residents remained under extreme heat advisories with dangerous conditions forecast this week in the South, the Southwest, and South Florida. In Arizona, an unrelenting heat wave's on track to break the previous record of 18 straight days of 110 degrees plus highs in Phoenix. That's Fahrenheit. Some of the most at risk include people who work outdoors, like construction workers, as well as unhoused people.
I've been here for 12 years, and I haven't seen nothing like it. It's hot. I fell asleep on some hot concrete, and my whole left side got third-degree burns on them. You know? So that's an eye-opener.
Europe could record its hottest day ever on the Italian islands of Sicily and Sardinia. Over the weekend, Italian authorities issued an extreme health risk in 16 cities, including Rome and Florence. Italians flocked to lakes and seasides in an attempt to cool down.
È normale.